Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for October 16th, 2011. I'm David McLaughlin. With me, Catherine Smith. Hey, Catherine.
Hello, everyone.
And up a little bit north of me, Tim Shiflett. Welcome to the show.
Well, good evening, sir.
Yeah, good to have y'all in. Well, we got some topics here to talk about the first good half hour of the show. Then Michelle Niemeyer from Coconut Grove is going to join us. That's one area of Miami, and she is running for the Miami City Council, and she's going to be our special guest in the second half hour. But we're going to talk about just a myriad of different topics here in this first half hour, and one that caught my attention, of course, Tom Jensen's one of our favorite guests we have on Public Policy. We love his work, and we don't know if this was his idea or somebody else's, but they polled the popularity of the states, not leaders of the states, not direction of the state, but just the state. And they didn't do all of them this week. They're going to rotate through. They picked a chunk of states all across the country, no alphabetical order. And, you know, I don't know, Pennsylvania, Illinois, I've been to both states, found interesting things to do in both. But people love Pennsylvania, plus 29. People not so much on Illinois, a negative 10. That's the polls of the thing, if you will. Our home state for the three of us right now, Georgia, is a plus 11, so I guess we got that going for us. Right, Catherine?
That's right. Now, what were the – I need to look at this again. I just think it's weird to ask people what they think of states. I mean, if you don't live in the state, what's your opinion going to be of it?
Your opinion of the state you live in
is going to be the highest, I would think.
Well, yeah, and different strokes for different folks. I mean, you know, if you like one state, you may not like another. And I can't wait. They didn't do Hawaii. I want to meet the people who have an unfavorable rating of Hawaii. I mean, those people are, I guess, really tough to please. Tim, give us a takeaway or two from this crazy thing.
Well, for starters, why did they pick these particular 17 states? Why were only 17 states even asked about? I'm not surprised, for instance, that Texas was the most polarizing state. Either people hate it or they love it. I think most people love it that live there, because everybody I've talked to from Texas absolutely loves Texas. And most people I've talked to that are not from Texas don't care a whole lot about Texas. Now, that might have something to do with politics or something. I don't know.
In any state, if it's politically polarizing, you know, the state that gave us George W. Bush gave us Lyndon Baines Johnson. So, I mean, why hold the good or the bad against Texas? I wouldn't have a negative opinion of any state. If Tom calls me, I'll just say whatever it is. I'm not going to be against that state because
we'll like it.
I may not want to move to a certain state, but that doesn't mean it's bad for somebody else. And they aren't going to do all states. They're going to do 17, and I guess they'll do another 17, and that's 34. And the next 16, so I guess it's three polls, we'll have all the states.
Well, let me ask you this.
Go ahead, Tim.
Let me just ask both of y'all this. Don't you think a lot of this also may be based on the particular physical beauty of that state? For instance, Pennsylvania scored so high. I've been to Pennsylvania. It is a gorgeous state, beautiful state. And I just wonder if that has something to do with it.
Yeah, but then geography-wise, Indiana's a pretty flat state. I mean, you know, flat can be attractive, I guess, but Indiana just doesn't go, ooh, to you. I mean, nothing against Indiana, but it was the second highest. It was at 19. Two that kind of stood out to me, Alabama and Mississippi, next door to each other, very similar states. I mean, you probably couldn't pick two more similar states. In America, the shape is the same, except they're mirror images of each other, have a lot of the same history throughout their, you know, statehood, if you will. Both were carved out of Georgia after the Yazoo land deal. Alabama's a plus one. Mississippi's a negative six. Other than the fact that Alabama can play a little better football, I don't feel a lot different from those two states. But there's a 7-point.
Well, you know, that's what I was
Catherine,
about. I was about to say, do you think this has something to do with sports?
I don't know. Idaho, what do people think about football in our sports in Idaho? I mean, I don't know. That's in Indiana. So Indiana sure can't play football.
Well, not just football,
you know,
but Indiana's,
there
been,
has to be something
Indiana's had a famous basketball team for years.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, obviously anything that makes you like a state, you know, could possibly figure in like one state and not like another. So something had to get in this. It'd be interesting to see if there's more that comes out about this. And actually, I've invited Tom Jensen to be on the show, although there's never a bad time to have Tom Jensen on the show because there's so many things he's polling on. But if we do get him soon, we'll may ask about this at that time. But it'll be interesting to see. We'll see more states. And of the ones, just people can know to look on public policy polling site, Georgia was the most popular of the southern states.
What?
Then Texas, Arkansas, Alabama. Louisiana was dead even, 24-24. Actually, more people were undecided. And then Mississippi.
Okay.
I guess maybe it was kind of like food good, hurricanes bad.
Okay.
I guess people had a mixed bag. I don't know.
Let me throw another monkey wrench into the works. Would this have anything to do with the partisan breakdown of the respondents? 41% Democratic, 35% GOP, 24% independent or other. Would it have anything
yeah.
to do with that?
It could be. I mean, honestly, you know, probably more interesting would be if you had to move to another state than your own, you know, what state would you want to? Now, obviously, there would be some more tropical destinations that would get higher. But then, of course, you would see some places that people wouldn't want to move to because of their political leanings. You know, you could get some of this information in different ways. But we'll just see as they flesh some more polls out and we get even more states, if you will, and maybe they'll have some crosstabs that come up out of this thing. Well, let's kind of get into some more topics. And one, I'm going to kind of merge topics. There's a thing in the New York Times that came out a few weeks ago, but probably one of the most fascinating charts about the presidency, but at the same time, we're going to kind of cross it with a Herman Cain's continued rise. We started seeing this a week or two ago, and it's just continued on, and he's now leading in the polls. I saw where he was going to be leading soon, and then before he came on the show, Tim said it's already happened, according to the Wall Street Journal NBC poll. He's actually got, what did you say, Tim, a 4-point lead?
Right. Right.
Yeah, and just so I'll, and the listeners will know and I'll know, how far has Rick Perry fallen in that poll?
Well, he's sitting at 23%, so he hasn't. I'm thinking of Ronnie. Perry has tanked. He's dropped down into the mid-teens. He has lost way over 20
points in
the last 16. Few weeks. Yeah, that's about right, about 16%.
Yeah, and I think basically what people were seeing or thinking was that it would be the first initial wave Cain got would come from particularly Bachman, and then the next wave would start to come from Perry, and then he may be the undoing of Perry. And then this, it seems amazing if this thing could come to a two-person race between Cain and Romney. We've talked about Cain in Georgia, and he's kind of entertaining with his singing and his truck stop pizza. But, I just never saw this coming.
In the space of eight months, we've gone to a different anointed candidate every little while. First it was Donald Trump. Then it was Michelle Bachmann, and then Rick Perry, and now Kane. And I am really,
well,
really,
Lenke
really.
Paul Lenke was in there for a short time, too.
Yeah, for a little while. But I'm wondering if this is the volatility of the Tea Party voters manifesting itself, and they are just moving from candidate to candidate, unable to settle on one.
Yeah, they just have an absolute mess. I actually was asked late in the week, somebody that knows that I follow politics pretty closely said, "So who's going to be our next president?" And I said, "I don't know who will be the next president in 2016, because this is where I'm getting into this. The Republicans obviously can't decide on a candidate, so therefore the president hasn't even begun to run against anybody. So therefore there's been no negatives put on these Republican candidates by the Democratic Party. It's been all, Republican on Republican combat, if you will. But then there's a piece out in the New York Times really close to the end of the month, the start of this month, that had this chart that I found fascinating. And it showed states where the president won by 10 or more points. I mean, that's a nice double-digit win. And then states that John McCain won 20% plus, whatever it may be. And then it showed those states in the middle. And they also put in there places where the educational level was higher, bachelor's degree or higher, and they actually kind of gridded this thing four ways. And I know I sent y'all this a while back, and I think I resent it today. And it shows that if the president wins every single state that he won by 10 or more points, which is really not a culprit. I mean, he could drop off 8 points off his win and still win. He needs to pick up 17 electoral votes. And if you look at the states that he won by less than 10 points, he could pick up about 2 to 3 of those and get it right there. So he'd only need to retain, in most cases, 2 of the states, unless it's an anomaly where he retains, say, New Hampshire and Iowa. But if he retained just 2 of those states and all the states he won by 10, he wins the presidency. Catherine, how important do you think this graph is as far as a roadmap is to the president's reelection?
Well, I'm sure that for the president's campaign, the reelection campaign, I'm sure they're looking at all these graphs and all this data just to see where they need to focus their energy and where they need to raise money and all those things. For me, I think I'm waiting. I mean, of course, I'm going to support the president. I'm a Democrat and I like him. I'm not unhappy with him like so many are. But I think that I think the key is going to be whoever the Republicans select, whoever floats to the top or the bottom, however you view it, and how we go about running against that person. I think, there's a huge number of people in this country that don't pay any attention until that happens. So, I mean, I think this is important for, outreach and for, making sure people are still registered and making sure the people who supported him in the past will support him again and all those kind of things. But ultimately, I think that until there's a Republican candidate, I don't think any of these things really mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, there is going to be some fluctuation. I have seen that the number of independents has risen. The president's not doing as well with independents, although the rise in independents has come actually a little more from Republicans moving to the independent category as has Democrats moving to the independent category, although there's been movement both ways. But that, I think, also has to do with how kind of strange some of the Tea Party movements have been. Tim, when you looked at this graph, what are some takeaways you had from it?
Well, I'm not sure that what the president did 3 years ago, winning states by 10-plus points, has a great deal to do with what's going on now. If there's a negative vote out there against the president and it's widespread, well, it's not going to stop at state lines. I still, regardless of graphs, charts, things like that, I still think it boils down to one simple fact. There are three states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida. Win two of them, you win the presidency. I see no way the math could dictate anything else. I don't see how anybody could lose two of those three states and win. Do you?
Yeah, I mean, there are mathematical ways to do it, but I agree. If you're losing Ohio, you're probably not retaining North Carolina.
Yeah.
Indiana may be one of the first to go. Another thing on this chart, I guess there's another axis that shows that Democrats, the president, do better with more educated voters. The Republicans do better with less educated voters. And if you look at this graph, and a real interesting state that stood out to me was Utah. It's a state where the educational attainment is higher than the average if you look at if you ranked, I guess, all the states 1 to 50, it's the higher 25. But therefore, but John McCain won it by, 20 plus points.
That's because
last
the state
time.
Is run by the Mormon Church, very conservative. You know, it's religion there in Utah is the overriding factor.
Yeah, I did see that. And I wonder when that will start to change. I mean, then, of course, I guess Indiana was an anomaly the other way. It's in the lower half educationally. It looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 states are all behind it in educational attainment. Most of the southern states in our region are ahead of it. They actually were a Democratic state. What?
There's another thing. You and I have talked about this before, and I went back and looked this data up. And this is a thing that really gives the president some real hope. In 1980, Ronald Reagan won 55% of the white vote. He won the election by 10%, won 44 states, a landslide. Well, in 2008, John McCain also got 55% of the white vote. He lost the election by 9.5 million votes and an electoral landslide. That's because in 1980, the white vote represented 81% of the total vote. Next year, it's going to represent less than 2/3.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I think talking about this the educational achievement in these states goes to something that's really been troubling me this week, and that is that I believe that 6, maybe 5 of the there's 7 candidates, right, in the GOP, 7 or 8, but
the 8+
at least
white.
Okay, so 8, at least 6 of them do not believe in evolution.
Yeah, but I will say this. If you talk about what actually impacts you, how we got here ain't really important compared to if you have a job or not. So I don't
know.
I'm not talking
that
point
that
matters one way or the other to anybody much.
It matters to me.
But it doesn't pay the bills.
That,
it doesn't
I'm not
give.
Saying it's something that people vote on, but I think it's an interesting an interesting point when you look at the fact that Republicans do better in states where the education achievements are lower.
I know that kind of argument into that kind of stuff
doesn't really get
us anywhere as a party.
But do you think that stat might have a lot to do with the fact that they are, for now at least, trying to appeal to Republican primary voters, many of whom would warn to the idea of denying evolution, denying global warming, that sort of thing? Do you think that might have something to do with it?
Oh, yeah, I think
In other words, they don't really believe that stuff. They're just saying it, maybe.
Oh, so they're liars. Okay.
I kind of find a false choice to have to tie those two issues together, because you could say, hey, if our planet burns to a cinder, because the greenhouse gases, that's a bad thing for our future. Evolution, whether you believe in creation or evolution, that's our past. So therefore, I don't even think you have to tie those two issues together.
Well, David, it's like
one does impact us, one doesn't.
No, but it's an indicator of – no, David, you're wrong. It's an indicator of belief in science is what it is.
Well, you can believe a lot of different things about science and not believe in evolution. I don't know that believing in creationism makes you dumb. I would reject that.
But, David, it's like comparing it to what I'm saying here. It's like comparing it – what do they all do when they go to Iowa? They take the ethanol pledge, don't they? Now,
yeah.
Do you think they all believe that? I don't.
I don't know. I do believe if you grow corn in Iowa, it creates jobs for Iowans. If you get more gas out of the Middle East, it creates more money for
that fund. Yeah, and if you're a politician that takes the pledge, it gets you votes at their caucus.
I would take that pledge because I wish we could fuel more cars off of corn from Iowa, because that's better than a bunch of gas from the Middle East. Both environmentally and, foreign policy-wise, to fund that bunch over there in the Middle East, then they have less money to, do more of their stuff. So I kind of see the ethanol thing, even though some people say, oh, it's really not that efficient. I like the idea of helping, Iowa farmers. Well, kind of in this, there's another poll that kind of throws into all this. They asked people, they said, who do you think's done a better job? The first 3 years of President Obama's term or the 8 years of the George Bush term, and President Obama won that by nearly 10%. And I think that's another thing that's going to figure in to why he's going to do better, because people are starting to say, the problem's been fixed. They have not. But were the problems what he created? No, I think people still are blaming Bush more than the President Obama, and I think that's going to also helping. I think a lot of this is going to figure in, so I think he's in better shape than some things show. I think Charlie Cook just had some information come out showing that the Republicans are even worried more about the House than people would have thought this earlier this week, and that's because of some of the rhetoric with cutting entitlements and probably some of Herman Cain's 999 things, where I think people start to look at that plan and they start seeing that the average person is going to get a lot of new taxes they didn't. And one thing I've always heard, if people want to go to a consumption tax or not, when you initially go to it, it's going to hurt the economy, because people, if they get used to that, would then stop spending. And at this time, I don't know if we could find anybody that thinks people stop spending would help us. Do y'all think we could find anybody like that, Catherine?
No, everybody, I think we all want, that's what keeps the economy churning, and that's why we want jobs, so that people have money, so they can spend money, so they can, it's a huge engine that has to be greased and fueled. And, everybody wants everybody to be, we also want people to be, reasonably responsible, but we do need people spending money. And I think you're absolutely right that if we have a 9% consumption tax on top of our local and state income taxes, sales taxes, it's going to be a harsh reality when it starts. And then the other thing that I think they don't talk very much about with this, because everybody wants to get rid of the IRS. Like, everybody thinks the IRS is evil, but if we're going to be collecting a 9% sales consumption tax, well then, we've got to have somebody collecting that. It's not going to be called the IRS. It's going to be called something else, but it's still going to be a tax collection agency. And the other thing is, the states that have no sales tax, like New Hampshire, it creates a whole level of reporting and, regulation that they've never had to do. Any small business that is operating in New Hampshire is now going to have to add sales tax collections and payments into their process, which is a huge
expense. Catherine, I didn't realize that New Hampshire didn't have sales tax. I guess if I get called up, even though I was going to say I view everybody favorably, I might even view them more favorably because, I think I like income tax better than sales tax because it's more progressive. I guess continuing on some of these discussions, and I've actually kind of lost my train of thought for once. I don't know why I got distracted. Tim, I guess that little factoid you told me, Catherine, just got me into thinking on that. speak to this, Tim.
You lost me there, David. I
think I've
you.
Lost the whole show. Let's move on to. I bet that's not happened a whole lot of times in the history of the Cubs Divide. Let's keep moving on and talk about West Virginia. West Virginia had their election about 10 days ago, and the acting governor, Earl Tomlin, won, and he gave up a big lead, and I think we talked about how it really – that we knew that race was going to tighten, so it wasn't that big a deal. But it did – was interesting because the Republican ran against the president, not on – with West Virginia issues, but then Tom Jensen's group, Public Policy Polling, put a poll out around that time, and it showed that the president's approval ratings had weakened in West Virginia. It's like we're getting conflicting information. Do we believe this poll that asked directly about the president, or do we believe that the people rejected a Republican that campaigned against the president at the polls? Tim?
You were right. The new polling showed that the president had dropped to like the 28% approval rating at the time of the special election, and yet the Democratic governor won the election by 3 percentage points. Now, what that shows to me, David, at least for now, that West Virginia voters have a disconnect. They vote Democratic in most state and local elections, and then, at least for the last three presidential elections, they have voted Republican. They voted for McCain by 13 points. Georgia, you know, used to do this. What I'm afraid finally that's going to happen, though, is that people will tend to vote more and more Republican in local and state elections. It'll bleed down, and if the trend continues, West Virginia might end up like Georgia has ended up for the last decade. Any thoughts there, Catherine?
Well, I don't think that – I think that people vote locally, they vote for candidates more than they vote for party in general. But I think in general national elections, I think they tend to – I'm just making this up as I go along, but it seems to me that – you know, you might like this guy who's running for governor. They knew him. He'd been serving as governor for a while, so they knew him. Maybe they liked his commercials, and he was maybe more approachable or something. So I think it's difficult to draw those conclusions. I think it's difficult to say, oh, since we elected a Democratic governor, we're going to vote for Obama. I don't think that that's necessarily a correlation. So I think that poll is probably more accurate. That's just my sense.
Yeah, it was just the reason I do think it. You have to bring it a little more. If this guy running for governor as a Republican would have campaigned on, hey, these are my ideas on what I want to do for the state, or even attacked Earl Ray Tomlin on what he didn't like about him or what he could use, I guess you'd say, which is the sad truth about a lot of campaigns, that they find out what they can use. That would have been one thing, but he did choose to make it a race against the president. I guess somehow he thought that was his best tactic in West Virginia. And West Virginia's state is one of the most unionized states in the nation, and that's why it's been so Democratic all these years. But then at the same time, if you look at that educational chart, it fits much more the profile of a Republican state. I have a feeling if it had the level of unionization of, say, Alabama or Mississippi, it would probably make Alabama and Mississippi look Democratic. Kim, do you kind of get that idea, the unionization
no.
and
no.
West Virginia?
No. The majority of union voters in 08 voted for John McCain in that state. I don't think that's it at all. It might be that way locally, in local politics. But national politics, no, I don't think so. Something different's driving it. I think that Gore lost the state because of coal. Now, I'm not sure what had happened.
Yeah.
sense. But what do you think of my Georgia model, comparing it to what happened in Georgia?
Well, I mean, if it moves, continues to move that way, I just, the unionization thing, I mean, if a person pays their dues to belong to a union and then they don't politically do it the ballot box, what makes sense, they're not following their ballot with their dues, where's the disconnect coming from? Because to me that seems pretty crazy, because to me, I know, you know, I can pay money to the NEA and they can advocate for me as an educator, but I know if I don't put candidates in there that support the NEA agenda, then it's pointless. Honestly, if you gave me a choice, pay, you know, $30 a month to the NEA, and or go to the ballot box every time and vote for public education candidates, typically Democrats, I know I'm going to be doing more good just voting, not paying my money. And usually people are tighter with their wallets than they are with their opinions at the ballot box. So it's kind of interesting. That's a discussion we could probably spend a whole show on, but we're going to be kind to our guest and bring her on at this time and maybe pick this thing up afterward. Welcome to the Kudzu Vibe, Ms. Michelle Niemeyer.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. Well, Michelle, go ahead and tell the listeners of the Kudzu Vine about your biography, your history, and experience in South Florida.
Okay, well, my history is that I've moved around a lot. I started as a kid living 9 places before the age of 5 with a military dad, and he went from the military to General Electric, which moved us just as much. So I went to 3 different school systems in Connecticut, Minnesota, and Indiana. Spent time living in Boston, D.C., Wilmington, Delaware, and now in Washington, in Miami. And I've been in Miami since 1997. I chose to go there because I really loved the climate, the scuba diving. I was a Spanish major in college, and along with economics, I felt I could do well here in this town, and I really love it. So I've gotten involved as a resident activist and have been very involved for about the last 8 years. And over the last few years, I've, you know, it's started with a lot of people suggesting to me that I run, and I thought, well, do I really want to do that? I knew what it takes to campaign. I know it's a huge commitment, but the more I look at what's happening in our city, I've really felt that it's the only option. There's a necessity to have good people in office, and if good people are not willing to step up, we can't have improvement.
Yes, well, I tell you what, all those states you've lived in, we got a friend named Tom Jensen that's doing some polling. We could just get him to call you, and you could give a firsthand account of a lot of the states falling off. But seriously, more about your race. You're from Coconut, or you're residing in Coconut Grove, and you've done some, you've had some experience there. Tell us about how that's affecting you deciding to run.
Well, Coconut Grove is part of the city of Miami. It's the oldest part of the city of Miami, or one of the oldest. It was originally settled in the late 1800s, and it has some very interesting demographics. A number of the people in this community actually come from families that have been 5-6 generations in Coconut Grove and originally came here from the Bahamas. And then we have, you know, it's a very interesting mix, because it's a part of town that has both highly affluent, pretty suburban area mixed with a commercial core that you can walk to businesses, restaurants, and movies, and an area that's not as well off. And, you know, so there's a real mix of people culturally, socioeconomically, et cetera. My work as a resident in Coconut Grove has touched on a lot of citywide issues, and that's really part of the reason I'd like to run for the city commission. The district commission seat I'm running for includes Coconut Grove, but it's also a much larger area of Miami. It includes the entire waterfront of the city of Miami, which is about, it starts at 87th Street on the northern end, for those who are familiar with Miami, and goes south all the way along the coastline until Coconut Grove. It's quite a long distance and a very diverse area.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of action in those areas, being the downtown area and still a residential area. Well, I'm on the show also with my co-hosts, Catherine Smith and Tim Shiflett. I'm going to let Catherine ask some questions, then Tim ask some questions, and then they come back to me towards the end. Catherine, what do you have from Michelle Nehemiah?
Well, thank you very much for being on the show tonight. We really appreciate it. We always like to hear from our friends in Florida.
Thank you, Catherine.
I'm a little curious about, I read a little bit on your website, and I'm just sort of interested in the structure of the, like the commission. So there's commission districts. Is there also a city council and a mayor, or like how do they all work together, I guess?
Well, the city commission is like what you would call a city council in some places.
Oh, okay.
We basically have a mayor, a city manager who does, the mayor is elected, the city manager is appointed by the mayor and is the business person in the city who primarily carries out what the mayor and the commission ask to be done by the city government. And then we have a commission which is comprised of 5 members. They're each elected from districts. And those 5 members make decisions about everything from all expenditures in excess of $50,000 to decisions about passing resolutions to the state legislature or the federal government about issues that affect our residents, to, you know, making policy decisions and passing laws that affect the city of Miami.
I see. Okay. I just wasn't sure because, you know, in Georgia, for example, we have city, like in Atlanta anyway, we have a city council for Atlanta, and then we have county commission districts for with commissioners. So I just wasn't
okay, and we have
clear
that
about
too.
That.
We have that too.
Okay.
The city of Miami is somewhat over 400,000 people in population. It's 32 square miles. When most people from out of town, when they come to Miami, think of Miami as the entire metropolitan area, including South Beach and all the places that you'd go when you come to Miami. We have a number of municipalities that are part of Miami-Dade County, and the city of Miami is the largest of those.
I get it. Okay, now I understand. I just wasn't clear about that. Obviously the economy is always on everyone's mind mostly these days. What other issues are your future constituents talking to you about? What is on their minds?
Well, we have a number of issues here in Miami, and most of them, although the economy is part of it, it really isn't the core of the problem. We do have very high unemployment in Miami, which is a very big concern for everybody. And we have, in the city of Miami itself, we have the highest property tax millage rate in the state, yet the city is on the verge of bankruptcy. And for 2 years in a row, the city has declared what they call a fiscal urgency in order to force the city's unions to the table to renegotiate their contracts. Basically, the city has been in such a dire situation financially that they've had to cut, this year it was $62 million from their expenses to balance their budget. So one of the biggest issues that I see is the need for the city of Miami to get back to the basics, to stop spending money on things that the city doesn't need, and to start just focusing on basic services and on reining in the waste, which there's a lot of.
Yeah, I noticed in your comments on your website that there's a lot of consultant fees associated with the city.
There are.
That's always a big boondoggle, isn't it?
it can be, and it can be, you know, I'll give you a classic example. We have a city attorney's office with many attorneys working in it who are paid very high salaries. And a lot of them are people who have very strong professional backgrounds. Yet every time there's any kind of a serious issue in the city of Miami, an outside consulting law firm is hired to handle it. And the city spends hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars a year, on outside consulting fees. In fact, right now the city of Miami is being investigated for SEC violations related to bond issues that happened a few years back. And they have paid over $1 million to the law firm that they hired to do the defense work in that.
Well, those are difficult issues to work out, too, and so I'm sure that your constituents are looking for your leadership in that. I'm going to turn this over to Tim now, and then we might get back around one more time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, good evening, and thank you for being on with us.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing quite well, thanks. You mentioned on your campaign website that protecting the community's access to the waterfront, of course, is a major issue with you, since, as you said, the entire waterfront of Miami's in your district.
Right.
Now, when you say protecting it, what exactly is this all about? Is this a public versus private ownership issue, or...
No. I'll tell you what it is. We have, in the city of Miami, we have a great deal of waterfront property, which is owned by the city of Miami and is now parkland, or is now, you know, property that hasn't yet been developed. Most of the property along the waterfront has been developed, but there are places where they haven't, and most of those places are city-owned property. So... there's a very, obviously, waterfront property is a limited resource. And it's my belief that when you live in a city like Miami, and, you know, we have a high cost of living here, people come to the city, not just people who come as residents, but people who come as tourists. They come to the city because they want to have access to beaches. They want to be able to get on a boat and get out on the bay. They want to be able to have their kids take sailing lessons in a place that's affordable, for instance, or to be able to go to a park that's by the water and go jogging along the water. It's part of the ambiance of living in Miami, and if it didn't exist, Miami wouldn't be as attractive to people either to move here or to come as tourists. And so that access is extremely important. When we have times of fiscal crisis in Miami, the city of Miami's standard operating procedure has been to look for ways to get an investor to buy something, pay impact fees, et cetera. So there tends to be an easy way toward development, and in some cases the city will turn over property that's city-owned property to private entities so that they can develop things on the water. It has to be done by referendum if it's sold or if it's leased. But if there's a public-private partnership to essentially privatize the waterfront, that can be done without a referendum.
Mm-hmm. Are you indicating then, by saying this, that in a city like Miami, it is very important that, shall we say, green space coexists alongside of extensive economic development then?
Yes, exactly. You can't, and I've lived in urban cores in several cities, in Boston, in D.C., and in Wilmington, Delaware. And, you know, having been an urban resident, you know, it's crucial to have those places where you have open space and you have a place, you know, in Boston it was wonderful along the river on both sides. They have bicycle and running trails and park. You know, in Wilmington, Delaware, they had the same thing. It gives you a nice place to get away and to enjoy being outside and not be just in concrete. So that's necessary. And just having that access. One thing that's very common here, and it's not common in the other places I've lived, is that the edge of the water properties a lot of times are completely private and shut off from the public, so that even if you've been to Miami, you've probably noted there are very few restaurants, for instance, on the water, because
mm-hmm.
most of the properties that are on the water are private and blocked off, and for some reason that's never been a value here. It's starting to become a value, and I think as you see the development downtown, et cetera, it's starting to turn that way, but it hasn't really happened yet. I'd like to see it get better.
And one final question, I'm going to throw it back to David. Of course, tourism has always been so, so, so vital to your area of the country. Do you see tourism still as the building economic block of the future of the city of Miami?
Not really. I see tourism as a very strong and very significant portion of the existing economy.
Mm-hmm.
But I also see that as if you look at the trends in the last several years, the trend that we see now, which is phenomenal, is that Miami is perceived by a lot of South Americans as the capital of South America. We have become an international gateway for business. We have the headquarters of a lot of international banks that have a South American presence are located in Miami. I know a number of people who are in sales and marketing for huge multinational corporations. Their jobs are to sell and to do the marketing for South America, and their offices are in Miami. So we've become a major international hub for commerce, and I see that as really the wave of the future.
Okay, thank you for this, Ms. Nehemiah. David?
Yes, Michelle, earlier in the year, there was some problem with the mayor's office of Miami. It sounded similar to a recall. How do you think that occurrence will affect this November's elections?
Well, I don't think it'll affect this November at all. That recall suggestion was made by one of the public unions. It was never really followed through with. So at this point, I don't see that affecting this election. The mayoral position continues until 2013. So the mayor's, he's halfway through his term right now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad that actually won't impact this election because that kind of convolutes things. Another question I had, I also do a sports show, and we cover all kind of southern sports teams. And we've discussed on there about the Marlins building a new stadium and then, of course, having usually pretty anemic attendance when they haven't been winning. And luckily, they have been winning for y'all, I guess, two or three different times in their short franchise history. Do you think this new ballpark will actually improve attendance, and will that be a boost to the local economy on game days?
I really hope it will. I hate to break bad news to you. They haven't even been good at having attendance when they are winning. I attended the last game before the last World Series that they won. I attended the last regular season home game, and there were roughly somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 people in the stadium. And that was when they were doing really great, and it was looking like they were going to make it to the World Series. So, you know, the thing is, the location of the stadium currently is a really, it's a very distant location for everybody. And, you know, it's in Broward County. It's far northwest of Miami. And I think, you know, hopefully by locating the stadium in Little Havana, it will create a walkable location where a lot of people who come from cultures that do enjoy baseball can get to the stadium. The trick is to be able to have ticket prices that those people can afford, because most of the people living near that stadium are not wealthy people.
Yeah, I'm sure if they've overpriced their tickets, they'll start having all kind of discounts this way, that, and the other. I've seen that a lot with, in particular, our Atlanta Hawks here in Atlanta. They figure a way to finally let the market price get some good deals. Well, I just know that we've discussed that, so I thought I'd ask you about that. I'd ask you what the secret is to getting attendance, but then, of course, the Marlins had hired you to be their marketing director, and you couldn't serve city council, so we don't
want
to create
a dilemma. Well, it seems like they might need one, judging from the past experience.
Yeah. Well, one question we always like to let our candidate guests tell, if someone's heard you on the show tonight and they want help in your campaign, what are some ways they can do that?
Well, there are a lot of ways they can do it. The first thing they can do is take a look at our website, which is www.michelle4miami.com. They can sign on to our website email. They can share emails with their friends and family who are in Miami. They can click to volunteer and help us by making phone calls, or if they're in the area, they can walk for us. I'm walking neighborhoods and meeting voters every day. They can walk with me. They can help us out at the polls. And they can also help us with contributions, because we really do have a need for financial contributions to keep getting the word out right through the election.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear you're walking. I'll tell you, Michelle, anytime I've heard of candidates that really come up with a plan to walk neighborhoods, they seem to always do better than candidates that don't. Not that that's all can ever be the total picture, but it always seems to be a little, just a secret thing that some candidates get and some don't. So that should bode well for you.
Well, it's very important. It has taught me a lot about all of the areas of the district that I'll be representing, which is just invaluable knowledge.
Yes. Well, best of luck to you in your election coming up in a few weeks.
Well, thank you so much.
Yep.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thanks.
You too.
Bye.
Yeah. Well, that was good to have Ms. Michelle Niemeyer running for city council down there in Miami. Miami is always an exciting place with great weather, but I'm sure when Tom Jensen polls Florida or even South Florida, somebody won't realize that physical beauty is a reason to approve a state. Well, let's kind of continue on. And, Catherine, I got to ask you about something. Just, I believe, in the past week, you have been named, elected, chosen 5th congressional chair. Is this true? Because I haven't verified it anywhere on the Internet. And tell us about how this came about.
Yes, it's true. On Thursday evening, we had a caucus of the 5th Congressional District Chair, and I was elected to serve through 2014. Yeah.
3 years, right. You got it, yes.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on that. Was this something you were seeking out, or did they just decide that you had some leadership skills of the folks sitting in the room?
Well, actually, I did serve as the vice chair up until about 6 weeks ago, when the fellow who was elected in January to serve as the congressional district chair resigned. He had some personal and some health issues, and so he resigned. And so I served as interim chair, and then we did have a competitive election. Another gentleman from the 5th Congressional District ran against me, but I immediately asked him to serve as my vice chair. So Kip Carr, who's a great guy, and I'm looking forward to working with him, he'll be my vice chair, and I'll be I am the 5th Congressional District Chair. And actually already did my first thing yesterday. I went to the DeKalb Democrats breakfast and was very pleasantly received. Apparently, the 5th Congressional District Chair has never, or at least not in the recent past, shown up in DeKalb. And, of course, anyone who knows the districts knows that there is a giant, there's a small piece of DeKalb County that's in the 5th Congressional District. However, it's packed with Democrats. So I'm anxious to work on that area, as well as, you know, most of the 5th Congressional District is in Fulton County. So I'm looking forward to working with the party and working with Congressman Lewis's office and, you know, helping the president get reelected and all those things.
Yes, well, obviously it's a big, important district because it is so Democratic. It's not like you're going to have to work to make sure, you know, seats stay Democratic. But in those statewide races, if the 5th district turns out in big numbers, that's going to lift the statewide votes and maybe some
exactly.
Regional election. That, so that
and
therefore,
honestly,
that's where it's important comes.
Honestly, with this reapportionment, the Fulton delegation will not be majority Democratic.
Yeah, so you
it's
can work
going
to
from,
maybe turn some of those seats. That can be one
yeah.
of your goals, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
If the maps go through, you know, there's all kinds of what ifs on that. But I'm looking forward to it. I have good relationship with the Democrats in Fulton County, of course, and now I'm working with the DeKalb, so I'm looking forward to it. Some people
well,
say be careful what you wish for.
Well, I'm glad that you got it. I think it's a good thing.
Thank you.
As a Democrat from another part of the state,
absolutely.
Although, you know, I guess my – yeah, so that's good to hear. Well, I guess we just have a little more time, and Catherine, we'll go right back to your district. I was down there. I parked at Georgia State. That's where I like to park when I go to the Falcons games, because I'm just not a big fan of sitting in stadium traffic. Maybe some people disagree with me on that. And I don't want to pay, you know, Governor Deal's hotlines, even if he had one on Marietta Street. So I parked down Georgia State. But that afforded me the chance to walk by and see the Occupy Woodruff Park, if you will. Now, I kind of get Occupy Wall
Street. It's called Troy Davis Park.
Yeah, well, Troy Davis Park, you know, I'm guess we've just decided to wash away whatever Robert Woodruff did for the city of Atlanta with one fell swoop. I guess Kasim Reed and the city council didn't approve that, though. But they apparently have a few more days to hang out, and then Kasim Reed said this little party's going to come to an end. I did see some people in Halloween costumes that were heading in that direction. They might have been going to a haunted house or a early Halloween party at SunTrust Bank or something, not anything to do with the Opera Occupy the Park protest. But what is people's take down there in the 5th District in Atlanta about the Occupy Atlanta, if you will?
Well, you know, I have a lot of respect for social protests. I do. I'm enthusiastic about it. However, I think this one has been relatively disorganized. And I do want to correct something about what you said. There's been a lot of talk about this comment or this statement that Mayor Reed put out about this Monday alleged deadline. I read what he wrote, and it did not say that they had to vacate the park at 5 o'clock on Monday. What it said was that they were free to stay there until the city council meeting was adjourned on Monday. It did not say what would happen after that. It just said they could be there till then, and they've come out yesterday and today and said it's possible that they'll be permitted to stay even longer. So I think it's easy to sort of interpret what he said as that they have to vacate on Monday, but I don't think that's what he intended to say. I didn't talk to him about it, so I don't know. But, you know, there was a little bit of an incident with Congressman Lewis last week where he just appeared down there. He just showed up. He wanted to see what they were up to. You know, he likes to get in trouble, and he's gotten himself in trouble a lot of times. You know, you'll hear him talk about it, I'm sure. And he wanted to speak to the crowd that was gathered, but they denied him that opportunity. They said that they were in the middle of a process and they wanted to finish that process. And some of us were upset by that because we felt like, why would you ever not? I mean, who would not want Congressman Lewis? Who in that kind of situation would not want Congressman Lewis to address the crowd? But apparently he was not upset by it. He said he understood completely that they were going through a process and that he got it. You know, he was fine. And they offered him a later slot, but he had other obligations. Of course, he's a congressman, so, you know, you would imagine he would. But so I just think they're a little scattered, but they seem to be across the country, they seem to be gathering momentum. People seem to be giving them a little bit more attention. So we'll see how long this lasts. And
Catherine, one thing I've noticed about these different Occupy groups around the country is there doesn't seem to be a spokesperson or a face that people can look on TV, for instance, and identify with. Do they have that there in Atlanta? Do they have
No.
that one person? No?
Not as far as I know. There's one person that is like their parliamentarian or something who they interview from time to time. And I'll be honest with you, I haven't seen any of the news stories. I've only read about this. And I have not been down there. I kind of avoid that like the plague. I mean, I'm not interested in getting mixed up in it. The interesting thing is someone approached my friend and the executive director of the Democratic Party, Paige Gleason, and said she should go down and offer them something. I'm not sure what. And she said they don't want to have anything to do with the establishment. I am, you know, de facto the establishment in the party. Why do you think that they would want me to come down there? And who am I supposed to talk to? Am I just supposed to walk into the crowd and just start talking to people? So I think, I mean, I think they're doing this on purpose. I think they're trying to be a very, you know, equal voice to everyone kind of organization. And, you know, I can't criticize them for that, but it does make it difficult to sort of figure out what it is that they want. That's the other thing. Like that,
yeah.
I thought that was what you were going to ask. Like, when you ask them what, you get a different story from everyone about what it is that they want. And
yeah, that's kind of, to me, the bigger problem. It's one thing not to have a leader, and you can talk about how you need a leader to function and all this, but they don't seem to have real goals, other than just, like, things that get put on signs that in some cases may not be realistic. I mean, if they had real goals, I mean, that's why, you know, they could compare to the Tea Party movement, and as much as I disagree with the Tea Party movement on a lot of their agenda, you know, they seem to get that, yes, if we get more of our people elected to offices, then we're going to move the country to the right. If these characters would say, look, we want to get more of our people elected and then go out and get to the ballot box and then move the country back to the right from the Tea Party, that would be a real goal. Now, of course, that would be working within the establishment, and they seem to be kind of adverse to that. And another thing that kind of kills me is the fact that you have the Occupy Wall Street movement, which makes sense. You have all these people just occupying random places across the country. It kind of be like at Woodstock. Yeah, they're having Woodstock with all the really good bands. Well, I'm going to go out to my farm and listen to some cover band. I don't understand. I mean, if you have time to hang at a park for, you know, weeks on end, you know, get a bus ticket to New York and go to the real thing. I don't want to go to this, you know,
Park. I think if you compare it to the – I think a lot of people are comparing this to the demonstrations against the war in Vietnam in the 60s.
But you can do –
And, you know, those went on in every – in every city across the country. And, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I tend to agree with you, but I also see that, you know, there's Bank of America and Wells Fargo and all these banks are in Atlanta as well. And those are really some of the targets that they have, these big banks who are, you know, they believe taking advantage of the working class. And I think that that's sort of – I mean, I think they did march to Bank of America the other day. Like I said, I can't really criticize them. I think they're enthusiastic, and they have something in their heads that's driving them to do this. I just don't see it's that organized yet. But if you remember, the Tea Party wasn't very organized at first either. They were all over the place at first. So, you know, we maybe need to just give them some time to get their acts together and figure out what it is that they want and how they might go about getting it. I don't know. I like I said, I have a lot of fondness for social protests.
Well,
sometimes people feel like
it's
the only way they have a voice.
Yeah, I guess if they want to play pickup chess with homeless dudes in the park, then they're in the right place. And then, of course, they're, you know, busy making signs and getting a little attention. But, you know, maybe if they figure out a little better spokesperson model, if you will, for getting their message out, that might help too. Well, I want to thank Michelle Niemeyer for coming on. I'm in the works for booking a guest or two for next week, but since nothing has been set in stone, I can't promise something. I'm not 100% on, but I'm sure we'll have something good. At least we'll have us, right, Tim and Catherine?
There we go. Good night.
Good evening.
Good night.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.